Welcome to the KHSU Magazine. I'm Natalia Estrada, and I'm here with the North Coast Journal's Thaddeus Greenson and Jennifer Fumiko Cahill. Hello again.
Hello. Hello.
Thanks for having us back.
What is in store for the journal today?
Well, this week's cover story takes a kind of a deep dive into the really tragic murder-suicide that occurred May 6th in Eureka and Fortuna. And so we're taking a really close look at that case and the main parties involved, so the victim and the suspect, and then also kind of generally looking at domestic violence in Humboldt County and why these cases are so hard to prosecute and so prevalent here.
The person who was the victim in this story, Sharon McDonald, she was very beloved in this community, and she was protecting a friend, and that friend is Jane Doe.
Yeah, it's our policy not to identify the victims of domestic violence. But yeah, that's exactly right. So Cheryl McDonald's a 60-year-old Fortuna woman who basically spent her whole life here and has large extended family here. Mm-hmm. And she had an old friend who she was helping move some stuff from storage into her place on H Street. That friend was Jane Doe, who had been in a about a 9-month relationship with this man, Ronald Crossland, and there had been allegations of domestic violence, and Crossland was actually had just recently been released from jail, stemming from that case.
He was on probation, though.
Yeah, and when he was on probation again from the most recent case, which stemmed from an incident at St. Joseph Hospital, where Jane Doe alleged that Crossland showed up and demanded the keys to her car. She works at St. Joe's as a nurse. Pulled her hair, threw her down, hit her in the face with a closed fist, and took her car. And she walked into work really shaken and reported to her boss and her coworkers what had happened, and they called police. Police came and arrested Crossland, charged him with domestic violence, carjacking, robbery. And it seems as though Jane Doe was fairly unwilling to participate in the case, had, according to the DA's office, had some reservations about the exposure, the prison exposure mm-hmm. that Crossland had, and felt like it was a bit too harsh. And so the case ended up getting pled down, and he served 8 months in jail and was released April 15th, so just a few weeks before the shooting.
And so he has a history, though, prior to this incident, right?
He has a long criminal history, yeah, dating back to the 90s.
21 convictions, 4 felonies, and drug and alcohol abuse.
Mm-hmm. And 36 contacts by the Fortuna Police Department since 2013.
Was this a weapon of his owning? Did he own the weapon?
At this point, we don't know where he got the firearm. The Eureka Police Department has released very limited information about that, just mm-hmm. saying that it was a small caliber handgun. Before he was released from jail, when he was sentenced, the probation department filed what's called a pre-sentencing report that outlines kind of all the risk factors of a defendant. And in that, they determined that he didn't have any firearms registered in his name, and he signed a sworn affidavit saying he didn't own any guns. But he obviously came across one, and how that happened is a little bit unclear. He was legally prohibited from possessing one.
It just kind of shows that maybe there are something slipping through the cracks, and that's probably not just a Humboldt County issue. It's probably, you know, a nationwide issue.
Oh, definitely. And, I mean, that's a question that we really want to answer, and unfortunately this story doesn't answer, but is the probation department determined before Crossland was sentenced that he posed a high risk to reoffend, mm-hmm. that he would need, you know, some pretty intensive post-release monitoring from the probation department. And then, you know, here we are 3 weeks after his release, and he's involved in this heinous crime. And we reached out to the probation department to ask about kind of what follow-ups had been done, what contacts they had with him since his release, if he was, you know, from their eyes, abiding by the terms of his probation. And the probation chief basically said that they couldn't answer any of those questions, that all of that information is under the ownership of the court, so to speak. And so we would need to petition the court to release those records, which we'll do.
A lot of times in these incidents, we focus on who the perpetrator was, what they do, and we especially focus on their past. But I want to know who Sherry is, and I'm sure the community knows who this person is.
She seems to be one of these wonderful people who just, you know, flew under the radar and didn't make a bunch of fuss about what they were doing, but spent most of every day trying to help the people around her. I sat down with her daughters and her husband for a while, and they I guess first and foremost, they said that they a situation where she stepped between a friend and a violent perpetrator did not surprise them at all. They said that was absolutely who their mother was, who Sherry was, and what she would do in such a situation. But yeah, she was working at cleaning laundromats, and they said that she would very regularly on cold night invite the homeless people who stayed around the laundromats in to stay warm while she was cleaning. She would regularly bring food for them, bring dog food for their pups. In addition to this, she also worked as an in-home supportive services worker, both officially through the county and then also in just an unofficial capacity of being one of those angels who helps people who need help. And her husband told a number of stories about, her getting a phone call late at night from somebody who said they didn't have any food in the refrigerator, and she would clean out their refrigerator and put it in a box and take it over to whoever needed help.
To make sure someone is okay over your own well-being really says a lot about who this, who Sherry is.
Absolutely. Her daughter Shayla told me a story which just really stood out given the circumstances surrounding Sherry's death. But she said that when she was about 6 or 7 years old, her mother took her to the Fortuna Rodeo, which I guess back in the day got a little bit rowdy. And they showed up and they...
Still does.
I'm sure. And they showed up and came across a crowd of people that was watching a group of young women beat up another young woman. And she said that Sherry, just without thinking, cut through the crowd, stepped in, picked up the woman who was getting beat up, and carried her to safety with her young daughter in tow. And then later, reconnected with her family. But after the incident, she was talking to her daughter, to Shayla, about it, and just said, that's not something you do. You never stand by and watch somebody hurt somebody else. You have to intervene. That's what good people do.
Powerful.
Very.
A lot of times, people who are faced with domestic violence are not just facing the violence, but they're also facing emotional stress and just kind of... They hope that this person will go back and treat them nicely again. And I think they have that little bit of faith that, no, this was a mistake. It's not going to happen again. What kind of culture does that perpetuate?
I spoke to a district attorney investigator, Lynn Soderberg, who I think put it really well, of saying that she never blames a victim for staying. That it's kind mm-hmm. of this popular cultural refrain to say, well, she should have left. She should have known better. Mm-hmm. And she said, you can't blame somebody for getting beaten. You need to blame the person who's doing the beating. And I think that's absolutely true. I think what's troubling to me about looking at Humboldt County specifically is, we have 50% more domestic violence reports per capita than the rest of California. We have higher rates of gun ownership than other areas of California. And there's this really stark correlation between domestic violence and gun violence. And, an average of 3 women in the United States is killed every day by an intimate partner. Most of those are with guns. There's also correlations coming up about mass shootings and domestic violence. By and large, the majority of mass shooters have domestic violence in their backgrounds. I think 54%, according to one study, of mass shootings include a victim who is an intimate partner.
Why is it so difficult to intervene and to stop it? I mean, is it because it's hard to see?
It appears to be, yeah. It's inherently a hard issue to see because, these crimes happen behind closed doors by and large. They're, as much as they're about violence, they're about power and control. And there's, plenty of studies that show that a domestic abuser will go through a process of kind of stripping his partner or her partner from their support systems, from other avenues of them feeling like they have power over their own situation. So it's kind of a
isolation thing, right?
Absolutely. It's a trajectory of isolating and stripping them of the ability to feel like they have any choice to make change.
Or any options.
Yeah.
And then when you consider how little faith, and sometimes rightfully so, a woman might feel or, a child might feel about the protection that the system offers. Mm-hmm. You file your paperwork, you do what you can, but for someone who has no regard for the law or for potential punishment, that means very little. What you're doing is not necessarily just about, a sort of hostage mentality, but also about self-preservation and the preservation of your family and your loved ones, all of whom this person probably knows very well and knows how to find.
Thank you both for being here for the KHSU Magazine. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.